One, two, three. What's that, an E?
A?
You're playing A. Oh, the harmonica's in A.
The harmonica's in A, and the ukulele's in E.
I thought you said it was in A.
Oh, it's all gone to pop from the very beginning.
Well, don't worry, we'll edit this out later.
And my spoons were out of tune anyway, so... well, you're listening to Thinkative, the podcast for philosophers, seekers, and the generally curious. I'm Tim Newton. I'm Tim Newton.
I'm Matt Parker.
And today we are discussing democracy and populism, for want of a better phrase, which we were just trying to work out earlier what the hell it meant. But we are, in general, depressed by the outcomes of the current state of the world, like many, many people. And we're not the first people to try and talk about this. But we needed to talk politics today, philosophy and politics. And who better than someone with a degree in philosophy and politics? Political activist, union rep, lifelong Spurs supporter, Mr. Tom Taylor.
Hello.
From down the road, who I'm hoping will be able to help shed some light on all of this. But before we begin, the important business has to be attended to of having a look at Tom's wine. What have we got?
It's claret, which, being a Spurs fan, is a bit unfortunate. Oh, yeah. It might remind you of wet sham.
Oh, yeah.
of what?
Wet sham.
Wet sham.
What's wet sham?
Oh, come on. Well, you can say
it's an anagram.
In America.
It's an anagram.
Yeah.
Get some subtitles
up. Yeah, seriously.
Yeah.
No idea what you people are saying.
I did hear a broadcast once where an American commentator described a North East Western football team as Wigan.
Wigan. listen, Tom, it's great you could join us. Tonight and on this snowy night in Leytonstone, and
I came all the way from Leyton.
Oh, did you? Oh, blimey, you've been crossing the borders. Well, we're doubly honoured. But if you want to break the seal on the cap, just to set us all
up.
Oh, look at that. Oh, he's done it. Great. Then we shall begin. Well, we're longing to, talk to you about your thoughts.
I'll pour a few
on all
mind.
Of this. Because obviously it's a great time of concern for a lot of people. There's a lot of swings and roundabouts going on, it seems to me. And, with the rise of Trump, with Brexit, which shocked a lot of people, certainly shocked me, I don't know if it shocked you. Cheers. All that, it made us just start to want to reflect on democracy and the way that the engine of democracy can create some very turbulent and interesting times, and if that's a good thing, should we be worried about what's happening? Should we be celebrating the fact that the popular vote has somehow brought about some great change, even though it might not be change that a lot of people like? Is it right that that's happening? I don't know. So that's why we decided to bring you in.
Oh, for all the answers.
It's only because you're a man with answers, surely, and thoughts and opinions on all this. I know, having spoken to you at length on lots of lots of issues, and I look upon you as a bit of a font of knowledge on these issues. So,
well, I hope I don't disappoint you.
Let's just begin with what democracy is. What is it? Can we describe what democracy is? The origin is, of course, Greek, we think. Isn't that where it originated?
Definitely.
Of course.
What kicked it all off?
And the origin of wine is also Greek, so cheers.
Cheers to that. Nice to...
it's the Greeks.
Yeah, again. It always is, isn't it? We've clinked a glass for many a Greek toast on this programme.
Yeah. I don't know if that's actually true. I was just trying to segue into the wine.
Yeah, but it worked.
Yeah. We know the ancient Greeks had wine. No, where they got it,
all we've got to do now is work it out to segue into the politics.
Yeah.
Well, I always think with these things, there's two critical sides. There's the theory and then there's the practice.
Mm.
And as people have said, democracy is derived from the Greek demos, the people, and kratia, which is power. So it's open to some reinterpretation, but it's supposed to be Power to the People in the Wolfie Smith sort of tones, as it were.
Yeah.
That's an old British TV programme. Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. Oh, you've got to keep that up to speed today.
Which at least one Wolfie of us here.
Take notes.
Anyway, but very interestingly, I remember when I was studying politics, at that point in time, every country on the planet, and remember we had the Eastern Bloc in place at those days, described itself as a democracy.
Yeah.
And with completely different forms of government, of course. And what if you do a search on democracy, it's really funny that when you get a reply, say, for Britain or for America, is that they conflate the theory of democracy with the particular form of government they've got. So in other words, that's how they can then claim that they're all democracies, because by definition, their form of government is a democracy.
Right.
So therefore, it must be a democracy. I think that's called a tautology in philosophical terms.
Right.
Anyway, I did a little bit.
So everybody's got their own democracy, and it can be whatever you like.
And so therefore, what probably is not really the problem isn't the people and how they're voting. Probably the question that needs to be asked is about the institutions that give rise to those votes, because has the form of government actually addressed the issues that people are concerned about?
Right.
And that would be my view, is that no, they haven't. And so therefore, what you've seen in terms of Brexit, in terms of the election of Trump, it's multifaceted, but on the one hand, it's a rejection of the fact that these people's issues and concerns haven't been addressed by what you might describe as mainstream governments. And the other side of that, of course, is that, you know, people tend to look at the outcomes of elections. What they tend to avoid discussing, although every time they get a little crisis, they then perhaps might raise the issue, is the numbers of people that vote. And what was marked about both the election of Trump and the referendum on Brexit was the significant numbers of people that didn't vote. So in other words, it's almost like, up yours, you know, I'm just not interested anymore. And there is an argument to be addressed, probably not tonight, about levels of voter disengagement. In other words, you know, it's a plague on all your houses. And that certainly was the case in America, where depending on which figures you believe, and funnily enough, if you search this on the internet, the turnout in the American presidential election is not immediately obvious. You have to do some digging. And even then, you get varying figures. I just don't know. There is an official figure for the turnout. But let's say it was somewhere between 50 to 58%. And we know that the vote was evenly divided. Yeah, so that means 42% of people minimum didn't vote, and perhaps as many as 50% didn't vote. We know the vote was divided between Trump and Clinton fairly evenly.
Yeah, quite close.
So therefore, if 58% of the electorate voted, that means that if the vote was divided exactly equally, they would have each have got 29%. If it was lower turnout, then they would have got somewhere between 25% and 29%, which tells you that, they say, the bottom line is that 42% of people, which is the biggest, would have been the biggest candidate if they'd have all voted for none of the above.
But they were disengaged with the process. They
weren't
interested enough in trying to make a change. So that begs the question, really, should people have to vote?
Is it a democracy? Yeah, that's the point. If the founding theory of democracy is representative democracy, which depends therefore on high turnouts. Remember in Britain, if we take that, it would be common in the, you know, post-war period right the way through to the 1980s for turnouts at general election to reach 70%, and for the party that won the election to secure about 45% of the vote, total votes cast. Now you see governments that get elected. What was it? I'll check this out. Very interesting. In both 2005 and 2015 elections, the winning party got about 35%. So you can see a massive collapse in single
party. You mean the winning party got 35% of the
votes cast?
Of the votes cast?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Whereas in if you go back to
fairly small
World War,
plurality,
yeah, you know, the winning party would have secured a far higher percentage. So let's say it'd be around about 45%, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, they're only getting 2/3 of the votes they used to get. So if you have a first past the post system, which apparently is a democratic system,
mm-hmm.
a proportional representation system, as they have in most countries in Europe, is a democratic system.
Mm-hmm.
But that then sure. begs different questions. But the point is that what the main theory behind first past the post is it produces strong governments. Mm. Well, could anyone seriously say we've had a strong government since at least the 2005 election and arguably prior to that? So it begs a theory about democracy.
Could you just give us a quick review for American listeners and maybe viewers that of what first past the post is? Because we don't have anything like that.
So what you have in Britain is about approximately 650 constituencies. So they're all geographical entities. Yeah. Each of those constituencies elects an MP, Member of Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And basically, let's say there's 100,000 voters in each constituency. They go to the polls, and then the person with the most votes cast against their name is elected as the MP. So in other words, you know, going back to our figure of 100,000, if the top voter gets 30,000, then that MP is elected for whatever particular party they stand for. The next highest candidate could get 20,999, and they've lost.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, there's supposed to be a connection between that system and what is described as democracy in Great Britain. Now, clearly, you know, going back, you know, there would be more candidates in the election than just two. But clearly, if you just said there were two at that time, then the vote is divided fairly evenly between the two candidates. And yet it's winner take all.
Yeah.
And similarly, in terms of the American presidential election, sure. you know, all the states can have a variety of systems between us where, you know, they have an electoral college at the end of the day. But one state can actually, you know, elect its delegates to the electoral college on a similar system, i.e. winner take all. Whereas right. others would say, you know, you got 40% of the vote, therefore you get 40% of the delegates, you got 20%.
Right.
You get 20% of the delegates. So it's a mix and match in America. It's even weirder than it is in Britain, where at least you've got the same system, irrespective of which particular constituency you look at.
But in that respect, looking at what was going on, certainly in America and Britain, is what we could probably talk about with the most authority, is that there's a big disillusionment then with the system. People aren't bothering to vote or are so so disenfranchised, they don't think it's worth it. So what should we do? Should we be looking to try and fix that and encourage more people to vote? Should we be looking at a different system? Should we be giving up? Should we be saying, actually, this looks sick? It's a dying beast, this democratic idea.
Well, the problem is, Tim, is that, you know, it's a question you could apply to every single. You know, let's just take the West and forget the rest of the world for the moment. We're looking at America, we're looking at Europe, we're looking at Britain in particular, which has a relatively distinct system. Is the second question which arises is not just the institution, but what choice when I say the institution, I mean parliamentary democracy as far as Britain, or proportional representation in terms of, say, Germany. Or the American system, which is a bit of everything, pick and mix. just to finish the point then. So you know, what you can argue then is, well, although it's parliamentary democracy and an MP is an MP, we know that the real world is that they are candidates of particular political parties. Now, in the past, you might argue that the spectrum of opinions that those particular political parties represented was pretty broad. What you might argue since Margaret Thatcher was elected and the rise of Blairism in Britain, that spectrum has narrowed.
It had narrowed, and
it's narrowed even more. You might, well, hang on, because we're only up to 2015 election, aren't we?
Yeah.
Because we haven't had one since.
We're
working on it. But anyway, so the point is that then, if you think, well, whether I vote Labour or Tory or Lib Dem,
I'm still voting for supporters of a particular political philosophy, and
meaning,
I don't support
meaning
that.
Their political philosophies between the parties are similar.
That's what I'm saying. The spectrum has narrowed. Right. So
not within each party, but among the parties,
between the parties and within the parties.
And within, yeah. Uh-huh.
So in other words, you've had we've had the rise of Blairism in the Labour Party. That has been challenged recently, as we know. But in terms of the last general election, because these are, we have to go on the figures, and the last figures are for the last general election. We know that the turnout fell again. We know that the percentage of votes secured by the winning party fell again. And so therefore, the opportunity for people to see or believe or hope that they can elect a government which might represent their kind of views or addresses their kind of issues is narrowing and narrowing and narrowing. That's why you see lower turnouts. And equally, what people understand only too well is that the scope to elect a party which, at least in terms of their official propaganda, falls outside that narrow spectrum, and in Britain, clearly, that would be UKIP.
Mm-hmm.
They know UKIP got 3.9 million votes at the last general election, which is in excess of 10% of all votes cast, and got one seat.
Mm-hmm.
You go back to the 2005 election, Lib Dems got 1 in 5 votes of all votes cast, and got less than 10% of the seats.
Mm.
So what people are starting to say is, well, look, even if there's a party that stood, because of the nature of first past the post and winner takes all, what is the point? And then what you start to see as well, isn't it, is particularly in relation to Brexit, that the real character of the Conservative Party was a mishmash between anti-Europeans and pro-Europeans. So you start then to understand far more clearly that the whole impetus of first past the post politics is towards creating coalitions, but coalitions within still a relatively narrow spectrum. And it's funny, I did economics in the mid-70s, and the kind of politics and economic policies that attach themselves to that were seen as to be one step to the left of the far right. They were seen to be supported by nutcases, and now it's mainstream politics. And so, therefore, you go back to that time where the consensus at the time was things like the mixed economy. Whoever hears that phrase anymore? So what's a mixed economy? It's a mix between business and capitalism and the public sector, defence of the NHS. And we still have some of that legacy left over where, as someone described the NHS as the official British religion the other day.
It is. It's something that we believe in, that we're always hearing about on the everyone's talking about cuts and the problems about it. Everyone's talking about whether we should throw money at it. The fact that it's getting privatized, eaten away. It's getting, like Noam Chomsky says, it's the way that you run down a public service like that until people get fed up and angry, and then you start harvesting it out to private funders. I mean, it's just being chipped away at. But just to go back to what you're saying about this whole first past the post.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me, loathe UKIP as I do personally, the idea of 3.9 million votes for UKIP, you would think, really, to be a truly fair democracy, provided that any party, the only parties that believe in democracy should be part of this democratic process, but anybody who gets that proportional representation seems the fairest way to represent the people to me, even though it leads to fragmented parliaments and real hotspots of coalitions
and,
like in Italy.
I mean, people might have seen in terms of TV the programme about Danish politics, which escapes me at the moment, but anyway, what was it called?
Bergen.
And
thanks, Gav.
What was interesting that underpinned that was actually a very strong impulse following the Second World War, where, of course, the Nazis had come to power and were defeated, and extremist politics you know, were elected under a first-past-the-post system largely in Germany in the 1930s, is that the move towards proportional representation in Europe was twofold, or the grounds underpinning it were twofold. Number one, to say, well, it's much more difficult for an extremist party of the right or the left to come to power.
In which system?
In a proportional representation. So with proportional representation, it's as I described with some of the American states. So you get 40% of the votes, in, you know, nationally, you get 40% of the MPs.
Right.
Actually, there's some variations on the theme, because in Germany they have a dual system where they have, you know, they have a constituency list, so there's some kind of local accountability between your, you know, parliamentary representatives and the people they're supposed to be representing. But you also have a party list. And we've seen some of that in some British elections, like, say, the elections in London for the mayor's office and the assembly members, etc., etc. So that was the first thing. It said, right, this system mitigates against extremist politics.
And how is so that supposed to work?
Well, because they're saying, you know, it's very difficult for any, you know, it's very difficult for an, you know, the fear which underpins extremist governments coming to power is that they need to win more than 50% of the vote in order to operate. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult for anyone to get that share of the vote. Yeah. So in other words, if they get less than 50%, so let's say it was the National Front in France, and we'll see this in the French presidential election, we will see that there will be another compromise between the right and the left, the conservatives and the social democrats or whoever, you know, in France, it's much more fragmented because it is a proportional representation system. They will gang up against Le Pen. We saw it in Austria, where the president was, you know, a professor from a green background, won the presidency against the Freedom Party candidate. And because, you know, the idea is it's very difficult for a very extreme party, whether of the right or the left, to get more than 50% of the votes. So therefore, have more sense.
So if their policies are extreme, then the other parties will oppose them as a coalition. They won't be able to get anything.
And they won't be able to come to government,
yeah,
you know, or the president, or, you know, any other officers of state. And then the second point about that is that, so therefore, let's assume even in an extreme case, you know, one of the, you know, what they themselves would describe as an extremist party got, say, 40% of the vote, that means the other 60% would be, you know, in British political terms, shared out between the Social Democratic Party, the Liberal Party, the Conservative Party. Yeah. So in other words, the representatives of those party, in this extreme example, total 60% of the MPs in the Parliament. But, you know, if all things are equal, they'd all have 20% of the MPs each. It might be one's got, you know, 25 and one's only got 15 and one's got 20 or whatever. But the point is, in order to be the government, they therefore have got to work together. And so and we had a slight example of that in Britain, obviously, when we had the coalition government, although it was a lot less honest than what happens in European countries. Because what they do is they publish their programme in advance. So they, and everyone knows there's going to be some horse trading after the election. The people vote. Everyone knows what each party's programme is. They vote for the party of their choice. But they all know that that party isn't going to have a, you know, 50% plus one of the MPs. And so they know there's going to be some horse trading going on. But again, that then leads to its own problems, because whilst it's one thing to keep someone out, which is a very negative reason, on the other hand, people know, well, the chances, again, of my issues being addressed, my concerns being taken up, are falling again because of the horse trading nature of the post-election period. And so they're finding that new stuff. And, you know, otherwise, why are you starting to see the rise of all these extreme right-wing parties across the whole of Europe? It's because people don't think the system works. And so, again, it comes back to the point, is it the people in the wrong, or is it the institutions that don't work? It's probably a combination.
Well, it seems to be a combination, because it certainly means that, you know, there's a lot, I mean, what's happening, you know, the rise of the right in France is of deep concern, really, for those on the left, certainly. And but the rise of Trump-style politics, which is, you know, quite abhorrent and in lots of ways to me. It's being done by a significant body of people. He's been voted in by a significant body of people.
Mm.
So those people's wishes, yes, it's to do with disillusionment. It's like, you know, all these deindustrialized places, all the people that are suffering, they've had enough. And they're using democracy, they're using that to make a statement. Now, they're making that statement, a lot of them, you would think, with a genuine desire to see some of the crap that has been spouting actually come to pass. So there, what do you do? You're faced with a problem where democracy, you know, or that particular version of democracy, and it doesn't seem like there's any one particular version that's going to work perfectly, but that particular thing is giving a voice to a lot of people who feel disenfranchised and angry. So that needs to be listened to. But what it makes people like me, sort of more liberal people, feel is very concerned for the future of the world and wonder about the mentality, because it's difficult to think about that mentality.
I think you're kind of talking about what they call the problem of democratic citizenship, right? Mm-hmm. So it's all a wonderful idea that everyone gets a say and gets to be represented, but then you start to worry that some people aren't really competent to make decisions for themselves or for the country. And I think a lot of people feel that with the Brexit vote and with the recent U.S. presidential election, that the people who won these votes weren't sufficiently well informed. And in fact, there was a lot of publicity about this after the Brexit vote, people Googling Brexit afterwards and saying, you know, I didn't think we were going to win. What's just happened, right? So what do you do about that? Should everyone really be able to get to vote, or should there be some sort of minimum qualification for competence to vote?
Should you get people to in pockets to take care of your vote for you? You know, should you go to people you trust to make the decisions that you want, and someone becomes responsible for a dozen votes and things like that?
Like an MP?
It's, you know, do you step it down like that? I mean,
there are some new ideas coming out now that I just saw, like, a YouTube video talking about this idea, how we could use something like the technology of Bitcoin to sort of vote online, and also to transfer the authority for our votes on particular subjects or subject areas to the individuals that we trust, without having to hold an election or anything, right? We vote directly on issues, but if you don't feel competent to vote on a particular issue, you're capable of entrusting your vote to someone else.
Well, that's that old issue-based politics, which kind of became, once, as Tom was saying about how, you know, when the left started to move towards the right and things got a lot more indistinct, politics became very issue-based, you know, back in the 90s, beginning of the, you know, the noughties. Everybody seemed to be voting on particular issues and holding views. Hence, you get a Labour Party, for, you know, an example, the Labour Party who are voting half of them for Brexit, the other half to remain. And there's all and that issue-based politics was a politics that I didn't quite understand, having grown up and experienced the politics of the mid-80s, miner strikes, things like that, where communities were polarised and and politics was polarised. Then, after the sort of Blairite debacle, when politics began to seem to polarise again, I was getting excited and engaged, because I suddenly recognised the politics that I'd grown up with. And I went, oh, I can see, yeah, the right and the left are polarising. Now I understand. Now I kind of connected with Corbyn, like many people did. I think probably my generation, as well as younger people who were feeling disenchanted with what was going on and politics in general. But now, it seems to have gone beyond that point to a point of polarisation that is really scary, and I don't relate to in the same way, because it feels that extremism, I mean, of all different shades and varieties, has crept into our... We're faced with a lot more, like a circle of extremes, really, be it creed, credo, politics. Extremism is on the rise.
And this is one of the things I think that Hobbes said, a fundamental problem with democracy is that if you have to win over the the favor of the masses, then you have to shout loudly and say things that are extreme and polarize, and as a result, you get a government that's more interested in polarization and fighting and attracting attention than it is in soberly deciding the best policies.
Mm. Mm. Well, the problem is, isn't it, is that, you know, you start with what seems to be a relatively straightforward problem, and then you get into lots of angles and interesting byways and whatever. I mean, my view on people like Hobbes, Locke and Rousseau wrote The Social Contract is that actually they were the ideologues of the emerging capitalist class at the time. And most of what they said was boring, to be blunt, but what the nuggets that you underpin is that they were all three vehement in defence of private property.
Hmm.
And secondly, you know, the whole social contract itself, which, you know, it's a word we haven't actually heard yet tonight, I think, in terms of, you know, what is the point of democracy? Democracy is supposed to be about freedoms, actually. You know, mm-hmm. that's what underpins the Greek, although of course only certain people are allowed to vote in Greece.
Yeah.
Democracy for the privileged. But anyway,
freedoms. But of what? Of choice?
No,
over...
It's about this question, isn't it? About how do you balance? You know, we're all individuals. We've all got egos, but equally we have common purposes. You know, we it might not be that your house is being robbed tonight. It might not be that yours is, but it might be that yours is.
Right.
But so therefore, we have a police force to stop someone, you know, nicking the crown jewels from out of your bedroom, or, you know, your own personal. But it's like an insurance policy for everyone else who's not getting robbed that night. Well, it might be you, though. It might be you a different night, you know. And that's what they try to balance, is this question of individual freedom, which is a theme throughout discussions on democracy down the ages. And what Rousseau described as the social contract between the individual in terms of satisfying what you might describe as collective needs. And again, we've covered an obvious collective need earlier tonight in terms of the place that, you know, the NHS is held in people's hearts in this country.
Yeah.
No, right. I can't think of anyone who would say we should abolish the NHS.
Hmm.
You know, not open. I mean, but then it seems.
No, they might have a discussion about how it operates, but they all believe it should be there to operate. You know,
even Thatcher, wouldn't she have sold it off if she?
No, they would. They knew. In fact, they just revealed in the cabinet papers, didn't they, that Thatcher knew if, you know, if she revealed her real views about the NHS, because her views on the NHS is not because it's the NHS, it's because it's a public service, and she's opposed to the state providing public services. Yeah. Full stop.
Mm.
But she knew, and this is, you know, a tactical consideration by a politician, that if she openly expressed her views, she would never have got elected in a month of Sundays, which the rest of
them. That's probably true of most of them,
though.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true, but that's what that's
except for Trump. Trump.
Yeah. It was being, you know.
He can say anything and he still gets elected.
But I think, again, you know, the political scene in, you know, it's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, you know, you don't know because it didn't happen. But, you know, I know quite a few people that have been involved in America. It's clear that Sanders' campaign energised lots of people.
Yeah.
Hmm.
It provided hope, as it were. And you know, depending on who you believe, there is a view that if Sanders had stood instead of Clinton, he would have wiped the floor with her. But that then, you know, Sanders' candidacy was largely at odds with the whole Democrat ethos of being, you know, as an outsider. I you know, if you stood a Republican and a Democrat in the same room without me having met them before, I'd be hard pressed to tell the difference between them. I think most people in Britain would say that about Labour under Blairism, you know, and whoever happened to be the Tory party leader at the time. And that explains why you're getting mass abstentions and, you know, some of these things. But it does come back to, you know, some of the interesting points you raised, because, you know, Australia obviously has, it's compulsory to vote in Australia.
Really? It's compulsory to vote?
It's compulsory to vote. You can get...
That sounds like a horrible idea.
You can get taken to court for not voting in Australia.
What if you just feel like, well, I really don't know. I don't want to vote because I'm an idiot.
You can abstain.
You can abstain.
But you've actually got to
go.
You've got to
abstain.
Go and formally
abstain.
Even
if you spoil your paper, you have a democratic right to, not vote, but you have a, but you have a democratic obligation to actually go and not vote.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah. Which is it's a bit like going to the pub and not having a beer, isn't it? Perhaps, but anyway, so therefore, you know, when you look at those kinds of systems, obviously they're still prone to the same kind of problems that we have in Britain. I mean, you know, when I was at school, you know, the subjects like citizenship, what's that? You know. Well, you didn't study any kind of stuff at, you know, up to the age of 16, no.
And really? Like my, up to 16?
Yeah, when I... When
oh,
I was,
see, we're, we were indoctrinated from a very young age about the sort of the foundations of our nation, you know.
Well, you're always pledging allegiance to the flag.
Yeah, pledging, which is a really creepy thing, thinking back on it. You know? Yeah.
Like, to American, I found that really strange. I went to the school, and the first thing they did in the morning
every was morning
pledge allegiance to a flag, and I thought, that's a little bit creepy.
It's brainwashing.
Yeah, and we had no idea what we were saying. All we know is we didn't even know where our hearts are. We're, you know, most some kids are doing this, some kids are doing that, you know. You're supposed to put your hand on your heart and say these magic words, and nobody even knows what pledging allegiance means until a certain age. They make you do it first, then later on you get to learn, you know, mm-hmm. what you're actually saying, which...
I think there's a problem, though, isn't it? It's because it did come out of the Brexit, post-Brexit discussions. There is a clear difference between intelligence and ignorance, and some people conflate the two. Hmm. And, you know, my view is that most people in a you know, a Western industrial society ain't really that stupid intellectually, although they might be very ignorant, you know, and I think that... It is not aided. I mean, you know, if you cast yourself back to the Brexit campaign, and, you know, I spent 40 years as a trade union official negotiating with management, you know, government, etc. You know, I looked at the TV coverage. I mean, if you wanted to find out about Brexit, the last place you'd want to look was the TV coverage.
Okay.
Now, we know, don't we? Again, this is a separate discussion about the role of the Fourth Estate, the press.
Yeah.
Now, do you really have, you know, I mean, where are the John Pilger, you know, famous investigative journalist in Britain, he's Australian actually, used to write in the Daily Mirror, you know, which is the biggest selling, it was the biggest selling paper, certainly the biggest selling paper of any kind of left of centre perspective. Investigative journalism. And it reinforced this sort of view of the Fourth Estate, that its job is to hold the powerful to account.
Yeah.
It didn't hold anyone to account, because it seems to me that most of the people who work, you know, for the BBC and the major, you know, newspapers, actually support the kind of views that are expressed by the mainstream. Mm. You don't have people who challenge it anymore. So if people are fed a constant diet, you know, this is like an advertising campaign. You know, you don't see Mars put on one advert saying you should buy a Mars bar, and everyone goes, oh yeah, I'm so convinced that I'm now going to go out and buy Mars the rest of my life. You have to have that constant drip feed of pressure.
Right, pledging allegiance to
Mars. Yeah.
But it's also another problem in recent years, the kind of internet and the way that facts and information and reporting doesn't seem to have any kind of filter or benchmark for truth. You can literally... So many people would just... expressing points of views by way of a picture with some text on it, as if that's some sort of truth.
Yeah. But that cuts both ways, right? So we have access to information very quickly that we didn't have before, and also more radical ideas that don't normally get published in the mainstream media. But also we get fake news and we get random stuff that's
and
made up.
How do we know which is
Well, precisely, which? Because you can have too much of a good thing, can't you? That's the problem. So, you know, I went to my sister's birthday party in June, you know, and, you know, there's loads of her friends there. They all know that I'm, you know, been active. And I had a queue, basically, of saying, Tom, you know, like, how should we vote on Brexit? Because I can't make head or tail of this discussion. I think, just to sort of shift it on a bit, is that, see, what was also interesting about Brexit is that, you know, we've been talking about how we have a representative system of parliamentary democracy in this country. Well, that didn't apply to Brexit. We went for a referendum.
Yeah.
Now, what was that referendum about? Yes or no? Well, and actually, that's what most people think it was. It wasn't. That wasn't what the referendum was about.
What was the referendum about on Brexit? Tell me.
It was about whether we should remain.
Was it?
Wasn't it? A member of the European Union.
What was the referendum on Brexit?
How was it actually worded? I didn't get to vote on this stuff.
I'm not so lucky, you.
In terms of how it was worded, or
yeah, what was the purpose? What was the purpose? Yeah,
what was the purpose? Well, also that was David Cameron's kind of way to sort of appease UKIP and sort of anti-European camps. Basically, he wanted a proper job, and he wanted to be a proper prime minister, not a coalition prime minister. And he kind of thought if he said this, he'd get more votes, and then it kind of backfired.
That's what came out of it. But going back a step, the key words were David Cameron. What this vote was the end of a process. So it's always wise to remember the beginning of the process. Cameron gave an election pledge, didn't he, that he would renegotiate the terms of British membership of the European Community. That was in the manifesto. He went off and renegotiated terms that no one could tell any difference from the terms we had before we went off and negotiated them, if the truth's told. So therefore, in a referendum, you actually end up with people voting for different reasons, or rather, although the question is the same, people interpreted that question in different ways. And so therefore, let's say, for example, you were in favour of continued EU membership, but you didn't agree with the terms that David Cameron had negotiated, how would you vote? You could vote yes and no, couldn't you? And that's the problem with referenda. Is that they try and simplify a really complex debate. We had the same problem in Scotland, although we ran different issues. In Scotland, there were two separate questions. There was a question of Scottish political independence. There was also the question of economic union. Two completely different criteria. So you could agree with economic independence, but support economic union. You could oppose economic union and, you know, support the if you do it in the old logic and you get your classical box and then you divide it with a cross,
like,
and you go yes, no, and those were the four options that were represented in terms of a choice between two options. So there were two missing options. Actually, there weren't two missing options. All four were present. And that could either lead you to vote yes or no, depending. Lots of people would agree for, depending on what you prioritise, perhaps. But, the point is that what happened in Scotland is that lots of people voted to reject independence because of the economic uncertainty that they believed would ensue. But other people believed, well, hang on a moment, we've got this narrow political choice being offered to us by Westminster. We believe that the Scots Parliament offers a much wider political choice and actually might start addressing our interests. And so, therefore, we believe we should have independence. Most people, when they actually did some more sophisticated digging down and polling on it, wanted economic union within a federal state. So, in other words, you have a Scottish Parliament and English coming together in a federal
political
state.
Political independence.
America again, where every state is part of... It's why it's called the federal government, as my 17-year-old might say. And so, do you see what I'm saying about... But that is called democracy, isn't it? Either the Brexit or the Scottish...
Yeah, I mean, and actually, on the surface of it, no matter how much it was obfuscated, it seems a very clear choice. You know, I mean, for me, with Brexit, I was just seeing it as wanting to remain part of Europe, and whatever that entailed, I would rather be... an element of what I perceive to be as a sort of burgeoning federal European Europe.
Which is undemocratic.
Yeah, but that's what I just said. I would like to be, I wanted to be part of that instinctively. So I was voting, and I think a lot of people voted. I only say that because I felt it quite strongly, and I imagine that people felt it quite strongly on the opposite side of the thing.
And my position was this, is that on any political question, and this is not strictly a political question because it has an economic element that's fused with it anyway, is you start by identifying your principles. And the first principle for me on the Brexit issue is the fate of this country's people better served by economic and political union rather than economic and political independence, i.e. cutting ourselves adrift from the continent.
Yeah.
Now, that's the first question that should be asked. Because if you answer yes, that we're better served by economic and political union, mm-hmm. the question which then follows is what are the means to achieve that end? Is it through the European Union? Or even if you don't believe it is through the European Union, then what other form of economic and political union do you believe we should have to replace? It also then allows you to say, well, yes, I do think it should be through the European Union, but not this European Union. It's got to be a more democratic European Union. It's got to, you know, share its resources out there. It's got to have different issues. And you cannot cover that range. That's just off the top of my head. You cannot cover that range of issues in a referendum.
Right.
And that comes back to the whole idea then of what are the institutions and how do they relate to, you know, all of these questions came up, by the way, in a discussion out at my sister's party in Ireland.
Mm, mm.
And the question also about the balance between, you know, a direct democracy and a representative democracy, right? Mm. Was it really a good idea to put this particular decision before the entire population of the United Kingdom? Or is this the sort of thing that people who think more subtly, who represent the people's interests, should negotiate and decide, right?
Mm.
And in America, we would never have a vote like this. You can't say, well, you know, everyone raise your hand. Do you think that the South should leave the Union? Or No. Mm. We don't decide issues by having a huge nationwide referendum. And if we did, of course, it would never be binding, which, of course, the Brexit referendum wasn't really binding either, but everyone's quite committed, even though, that you know,
political calculation.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, there was this idea at the time that Michael Gove said, oh, we shouldn't believe in experts, which was kind of denouncing his old job as a politician, as an MP, who's supposed to like study these issues and actually represent people. So it's like saying, you know,
saying we should not believe in experts.
Rather than go to a doctor, I'm just going to ask everybody I meet.
The problem is British economic experts are of the same ilk as the British weather forecasters who said there wouldn't be a big storm in 1987. They consistently get everything wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there you are. Yeah. And the point is, at least in the NHS, you have to do exams and qualify to be a doctor, and so therefore you might be fairly well qualified to comment on your sickness. This is the problem, is that most, you know, it's like my nephew does economics. I know far more about economics than he does because he's only studied a really narrow range. It's a bit like saying I'm an expert in philosophy, only ever having read John Hobbes or something, and never read Karl Marx or, you know, Socrates or somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, it's such a narrow range.
So where when it comes to Marxism, you know, what, as a political philosopher that rings your bell, where does democracy fit in his vision?
Well, effectively, it's bizarre that, you know, that people attribute to Marx this sort of great revolutionary worldview when it comes to democracy.
Mm.
You know, I mean, he was opposed to, you know, capitalist democracy because he said it wasn't democracy at all. And, you know, we've discussed some of the issues which show that it isn't democratic by any, you know, statistical measure of the word. You know, there's, you know, oddities about it. Let's describe it as that for the moment. But actually, Marx's grand theory of socialist democracy was lifted wholesale from the trade union movement.
Mm.
So they have what they call participatory democracy.
Okay.
Most of them have probably forgotten that by now, by the way, because they were founded over 100 years ago. So basically, and funny enough, this debate is being reflected within Momentum at the moment, and this false dichotomy that's being posed between one member, one vote, and activists, I think, you know, they might call it. I was trying to know what the word was earlier. But anyway, and, you know, what most trade unions do, their parliament, as it were, for making policy decisions is usually their annual conference. So if we take the union that I was involved in, the Public and Commercial Services Union, again, the union was divided into branches. It wasn't quite as simple as the parliamentary democracy model. Geographically, they are geographically based, but you've got different departments as well. So you can have more than one union branch in the same town, is what I'm saying. So, but basically, each branch elects its delegates to conference. Branches have the right to send motions into conference. They elect the conference arrangements committee. They have opportunities to challenge the business that the conference arrangement committee recommends to people. And then at the end of the day, the delegates vote. And that, you know, if the motion is carried, it becomes the policy of the union. Now, the delegates are all, you know, every member has the right to elect the delegates. Equally, what the rules of a lot of unions say is that where a decision is taken that relates to, say, the fundamental principles of the union, which are set out in the union constitution, then that conference decision then has to be endorsed via a membership ballot, an all-members ballot, yeah? So in other words, your momentum, right, you've got this counterposing between one member, one vote, and a representative democracy system.
Which echo the thing you were just talking about, that idea of entrusting your vote to someone on issues. So it's like, you know, mini you know, representatives of smaller groups of people coming together to make bigger decisions.
Yeah, and you know, for example, you know, once the conference agenda's been published, you know, I mean, most branches will, you know, you've got the same people working in the same workplaces, not just for 6 months, but more like 6 years or whatever. So the odds are on that you know, the big, you know, what are the big issues for union members? Pay, staffing, health and safety. Well, those issues don't go away. They're constant. And so you don't really need to have a discussion about that. But it might be, for argument's sake, that someone says that this union is you know, appalled by the election of Donald Trump, and therefore resolves, you know, not to have anything to do with him, you know, or opposes a visit to, you know, I'm making it
you
up.
You might have some kind of a resolution just for the sake of passing a to make a statement, right?
Yeah, so something like that. And so therefore, you know, the people, the representatives that you were talking about earlier would generally know what the policies the branch and the members have supported over the years have been. And so they would then, at the sort of specially convened meeting, would then decide, well, what issues are there that we actually haven't got an existing policy on? And then you would have a discussion with the members. So this is the participatory element of that. Now, you contrast that again with the referendum, whereby, you know, it's very difficult to convene a meeting of all 60 million people of Britain in the same room at the same time. Yeah. But there could have been something done. There could have been far more public meetings. You know, it seems to me as well, one of the big problems, as I say, I mentioned the press. Now, it was very easy, wasn't it? You know, you can have fact-checking. You can have fact-checking. Now, you know, one of the problems with British politics is they never agree on a definition of the facts they're checking in the first place. You know, that's one. You know, that was one of the first things that I had to do in a magistrate, say, let's agree what we're actually talking about. Once you've agreed what you're talking about, it's much easier, isn't it, to then say, right, well, OK, if we're talking about this segment of table and we're saying that, you know, this 25% of this table is dirtier than the rest of it, then you can't then say that 25% of the table is dirty because the rest of the table might be spotlessly clean.
I doubt it, but well, yeah, there's a possibility.
Not in your eyes. but you can see how you can then distort things. Because if I'm talking about this segment of the table and you're talking about the whole table in terms of its relative cleanliness, we're not even having the same discussion. I'm talking apples, you're talking pears.
Did that bendy bananas.
Yeah.
Did that, there's no penalty either.
So, I mean,
when you have, like, your doctor analogy, if the doctor screws up, there's a penalty for screwing up in a legal sense, whereas a politician can just sort of say anything and there's no going back, essentially. So you can talk at opposite ends and then...
I mean, it seems to me that democracy's got to have a real clarity of information in democracy.
That's what you were saying.
Yeah.
Funny enough, democracy...
But we can't have clarity of information. It's impossible. It can't be done, right? Because if you have... systems in place to squelch lies and bullshit, then they're going to be abused to squelch truth and radical thinking that we need.
Mm.
But the point is, isn't it, is that that's the theory which underpins the effective operation of democracy, mm. is that there's perfect knowledge in a perfect market, which, funny mm. enough, is exactly the same theory that was outlined by Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations,
yeah.
in terms of trying to explain how a capitalist economy.
It's an idealization operates. That helps you to give a simple account of how things work. But it's, you know, later on you have to factor in the friction.
And that's why we see these anomalies, which because people haven't got perfect information. We can't far say that it. Every single one of the 60 million people in Britain or the 250 million people in America who had mm. the vote had the same level of knowledge and understanding.
Mm. Not even the same level of education, of basic yeah. education. And, I mean, some people would argue that in order for democracy to work, we have to ensure that the populace is educated, and that may mean that we have to fund a high-quality education for everyone, even if they don't need it for their careers, right? And nobody's doing this.
So it's more important to have the education to sift the information, knowing that the information is going to be far from perfect
or
true.
Or indeed, if we're talking about representative democracy, is that we have people in the public realm who are able to challenge claims that are being made. You know, we saw the big bus saying there's going to be an extra £350 million for the NHS, didn't we? Did anyone seriously challenge that claim in the whole course of the referendum?
And no one's held accountable for it.
No one's held accountable for it.
No, there was no accountability. But there was challenging. People were saying, so that money is going to go, is it, you know, to the NHS. I mean, the thing about politicians is they're constantly challenging each other's statements, aren't they, really? Mm. There is challenge, but it seems.
But it was a very negative, because you'll remember Osborne saying, "Look, if you vote to leave the EU, again, you know, I mean, I'm not saying he said that in exactly those terms, but he was saying the consequence of a vote, no, or whatever it was, I can't remember which way round it was now, would be that there would be a massive increase in the austerity agenda. In other words, more services would be cut, you know, less funding available.
Mm.
So it was a scare tactic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it seems to me, again, if you're talking about a matter of principle, are we or are we not going to remain in the EU, which I think most people believe that the referendum was about, then isn't it better to have the debate along the lines of what your principles are? That's my question.
Mm.
Mm.
And scaremongering isn't about setting out principles. It's scaremongering.
Mm.
I like this. I'm interested in this idea that we need people who are able to call out the lies and the misinformation. But I worry that it just doesn't make any difference because of, you know, that I think the Bush administration really perfected this technique where they just go out and tell any lie they want.
Mm.
It makes a lot of news. Then, you know, somebody calls them on it. Maybe they'll even retract it. Nobody cares. Nobody pays any attention to the retraction. The damage is already done.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the UKIP was pulled up before a select committee, wasn't it? And he said, where did you get your figures from? And you know, they got TV cameras. And he just said, well, I don't know. But essentially, didn't they? And he said, well, I can't justify them. So they got the government officials saying you can't substantiate your figures. But that didn't really become like a media projection out there,
no.
did it?
And that's because, you know, I mean, you know, again, it's a personal view. It's
so much of a story anyway. We're used to politicians lying. So, you know, doesn't
be an economical with the truth, I think the phrase
but
is.
But the interesting thing now is you can pretty much have any opinion, not just politically. You can think that the moon is hollow and filled by Nazis. You can now find articles and videos on YouTube to support that. Yeah. You know, you can form a club of people who think crazy things because before you might have been a lone person stuck in a
bedroom, place to keep the Nazis.
printing out a little leaflet that nobody ever read.
Mm.
But now you put this view out there and somebody else will latch onto it and soon they'll form a group and they'll make videos and other people will go, that's the confirmation I need. There's a YouTube video about this. It must be true.
Mm.
And so it gets harder and harder
we do have a public, you know, sector broadcaster. And, you know, they have a, you know, their role is not to be impartial. You know, it's a myth that's been perpetrated. The BBC's role is to be impartial. It's not. It's to be balanced. That's what it is to be. You know, if you're a left-wing socialist,
yeah,
and you've confronted them with a right-wing UKIP member, how can you have impartiality when they're both sitting at the same table? You know, they're not going to agree on anything in a million years. So it's about balance. And, you know, when you look at the BBC, I mean, the number of times that Nigel Farage has been on Question Time, you know, that party, as we know, has got one MP. Well, funny enough, so have the Greens. Mm. Any time has Caroline Lucas been on? Now, you know, that's again about balance. If you keep putting on right-wing views, I mean, you look at the Question Time panels. I mean, seriously, do you know what I mean? It's like they get a token lefty on in the same way that some debates put a token woman on or a token black person, you know.
So that's strange, isn't it? When I was a kid, they used to sort of show clips from like Pravda on the TV and then you'd sort of sneer at it, saying, like, look how sort of propaganda model this broadcast is from Russia or something like that. Mm. But now it seems like our media has really taken on that approach. Like, it seems like how we used to think of Pravda. It's got an agenda and it's trying
Oh yeah, sure. And it's a bit more ashamed. I mean, yeah, but I mean,
well, you know, we've gone an hour.
Yeah,
it's been just about an hour now.
Oh yeah,
I don't want to go too much longer.
No, we need to. But I mean,
cast your vote.
Well, cast your vote now. Should we keep it? Should we get rid of it? It is an imperfect system in an imperfect world. But I mean, we've had it for what, at least 2,000 years, and it seems
only briefly.
Oh really?
With the Greeks, and then democracy disappeared from the face of the earth until what? Until the 18th
century.
We had
aristocracies and
so we brought it back.
Monarchies.
Yeah.
Isn't that... So it must have some merit. It must be the best thing we can think of doing at the
so
moment.
So far, yeah. It seems to be. And it's interesting because I did a little bit of looking into how democracy got started with the Greeks. And I couldn't find out much about the details, but apparently there was... class conflict, you know, because the Greece, Greece at the time was ruled by an aristocracy, and there's the poorer classes were feeling mistreated and abused by the aristocracy. So somehow they negotiated an agreement in which they would have more say, right?
Power sharing.
Yeah, and it seems to be just sort of the natural outcome of this sort of conflict between groups, and so. It's kind of surprising in that sense that it was dormant for so long, but it does seem to be a natural thing.
Yeah.
Well, it's not natural, I'd say. It's you know.
Well, natural in a sort of sociological sense.
Well, you know what the classic Marxist analysis is between base and superstructure. So you know, any kind of economy can give rise to a variety of governments. So we know in Germany, for example, we had a Nazi government. We've also had, you know, governments led by social democrats and quite left-wing social democrats in historic terms. But the system was still capitalist.
Mm.
You know, what we had before was it was a political system that was based on feudalism, where the interests of church and state were fused largely, and so therefore the king was God's representative on earth.
Mm.
But that was you know, levied as it were by saying that the aristocracy, you know, had responsibilities as well as rights and powers, and so you know, you effectively under capitalism, you might say that the question of looking after the masses was contracted out to the masses themselves, you know, because under a feudal system, it was the king. And then through, you know, the knights and the squires and whatever, you know, to make sure that their people didn't starve to death.
Yeah.
Mm. Now, you know, you look at, say, you know, America, 12 years a slave and whatever, is one of the big problems with slavery is that the slave owners had to feed all the slaves because they were just no different to a machine, were they, really, in terms of, you know, the economic relationship between what they were doing and what the, you know, the slave owner, you know, the slave owner weren't in the business of being a slave owner. The slave owner was in the business of farming.
Right.
That was their job, you know, whatever. So it became an economic cost. The system was inefficient.
Mm.
And, you know, you contrast that with the North, where you've got, you know, the development of capitalism, factory output and so on and so forth. And so, therefore, that tends to lend itself, an agrarian rural economy tends to lend itself to a form of dictatorship, be it a monarchical system, whereas a modern-day industrial system lends itself to some kind of democracy, you know, parliamentary democracy. And look at the history of Russia, you know, before 1917.
Yeah.
Very interesting. The main uprising in Russia started in the Putilov Works, which was the most advanced factory in the whole of the world.
Mm.
Employed in 1917, so like 28,000 workers, which dwarfed virtually any other.
So, as an industrialised nation, we
can't have feudalism and
we can't
capitalism.
Have feudalism. We need.
Yeah, you can't have a feudal political system grafted on to a more modern capitalist democracy. Although, funny enough, we've still got a queen.
Well, cheers, Tom.
Very democratic one.
Thanks very much.
Yeah. Cheers.
Yeah. I cast my vote for cheers. This little cheeky drop.
Yeah. Cheers, Gav. And we'd like to present you with a thinkative pencil for coming on the show.
Oh, brilliant.
There sure. you go.
It's not got my broken lead inside it, has it? Like all the rest of the
might,
get
we,
these.
We haven't x-rayed them, so.
Yeah.
But, no promises.
Hopefully you'll come back again and maybe we can talk more politics another time.
Yeah, as long as I don't have to bring the wine.
Yeah, well, that's, I'm afraid. You'll get another pencil there. It's a Bakewell tart for later as well. Thanks,
all right.
Tom.
E this you. Time? 2, 3.
What are we talking about now?
Are we
talk about
wet sham. We're talking about wet sham.